This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. Stories. Stories is not part of the title, but they are stories. By me, Raphael Bob Waxberg. Read for you by Stephanie Beatriz, Will Brill, Coleman Domingo, Raul Esparza, Emma Galvin, Kimiko Glenn, Nicholas Gonzalez, Natalie Morales, James Urbaniak, Baron Vaughn, and me, Raphael Bob Waxberg. Okay, here's the book. Let's do it. Let's just get started, right? Let's go. First story. Come on. Okay, I hope you're ready for the book because it's starting now. Salted Circus Cashews, Swear to God, read by me, Raphael Bob Waxberg. The date is going well. He's handsome and charming and everything he claimed to be on the website. She likes him, she decides. He's the kind of guy you could introduce to your friends, she decides. After dinner, he invites her back to his place. He opens a bottle of wine and pours her a glass. He also offers her a tall, skinny can with a rubber lid. Salted circus cashew? What is a circus cashew? She asks. Open it up, he says. See for yourself. She looks at the can. The label says, The Cashew Company's Very Own. And then in big bold letters, Salted Circus Cashews. And then in smaller letters, Tasty, Salty. And then in even smaller letters, Ingredients, Cashews, Salt. And then on the side, there's a drawing of a man with a whip, a lion tamer. The whole design of the can is circus themed. And the lion tamer has a speech balloon coming out of his mouth. And inside the speech balloon, it says, Hello, friends. Please enjoy these freshly salted circus cashews, courtesy of the Cashew Company. Made with the finest ingredients combined to perfection, this can contains only the best salted circus cashews. There certainly isn't a fake snake wrapped around a spring that will jump out and startle you when you remove the top, if that's what you were thinking. No, no. Perish the thought. Only cashews here, I swear to God. I am being 100% sincere about the cashews. Why would there be a snake in here? That's crazy talk. Look, if you open this can and a pretend snake jumps out at you, then you have my permission to never trust me again. But why would you want to miss out on the opportunity to eat delicious salted cashews just because of the slight off chance that this is all an elaborate ruse to make you appear foolish? Okay, I see you are still not opening the can. And I understand that. Maybe you are right to be cautious. You have been lied to before, after all. Your heart is weathered and scarred, mishandled by many, eroded by time. You're no dummy, and yet, repeatedly, you stumble over the cracks of your cobblestone heart. You let your naked, foolish hopes get the better of you. Perhaps every can of cashews has a fake snake lurking, but you keep opening them. Stupidly, because in your heart of hearts, you still believe in cashews. And every time you discover the cruel fiction of the cashew can, you swear to yourself you'll trust a little less next time. You'll be a little less open, a little more hard. It's not worth it, you say. It just isn't worth it. You're smarter than all that. From now on, you're going to be smarter. Well, I'm here to tell you that this time will be different. Even though I have absolutely no evidence to support that claim. Open this can and everything will be okay. The salted circus cashews are waiting. They are so savory and delicious. You will be so glad you put your faith in me. This time is different. I promise you it's different. Why would I lie to you? Why would I want to hurt you? This time, there is no snake waiting. This time, things are going to be wonderful.
Short stories.
Read by Coleman Domingo.
Baron Vaughn.
Natalie Morales.
Kimiko Glenn.
And James Urbaniak.
1. There are two kinds of people, he thought. The people you don't want to touch because you're afraid you're going to break them. And the people you don't want to touch because you're afraid they'll break you.
2.
It occurred to her that she loved the idea of being in a relationship more than she loved any person she'd actually been in a relationship with.
3. You're not like other girls, he said to every girl.
4. She told him she loved him and cared about him, and he was so dizzy in love himself, he didn't realize she was breaking up with him.
5. He didn't trust anyone who looked better in photographs than she did in real life. He was working out a system where eventually he wouldn't have to trust anybody.
6. I never thought I could be this happy, she imagined one day saying to someone.
7. I don't even think about you, he couldn't wait to tell her, just as soon as she called him back.
8. He had this really amazing party trick, where sometimes he could go a full hour without even once being suddenly reminded of the paralyzing truth that his life was finite and unrepeatable.
9. It occurred to her that she loved the idea of her husband and children and all her friends and her job and her life. She loved the idea of everything.
10. There are two kinds of people, he thought. The people you don't want to touch because you're afraid you're going to break them. And the people you want to break.
A Most Blessed and Auspicious Occasion, read by Raul Esparza. So if you ever want to hear a whole bunch of people's opinions about the right way to have a wedding, the best thing to do is tell people you're getting married. And then I guarantee you will be up to your armpits in other people's opinions. For me, personally, the hearing everyone's opinion part was not the number one reason I asked Dorothy to marry me. I asked her to marry me because I love her. But as soon as we tell people, everyone takes this as their personal hand-delivered invitation to tell us exactly what we must do. You must line the aisle with candles, says Dorothy's best friend Nikki, like as soon as we tell her, like before she even says congratulations. And the candles should ascend in height all the way up the aisle as a symbol for how your love and commitment grow stronger and burn brighter every day. We're trying to keep things small and simple, I say. We really don't want our wedding to turn into a big complicated production. But Peter, you have to have candles, Nikki says. Otherwise, how will the half-blind love demon transcribe your names in the book of eternal devotion? Oh, Dorothy cringes. I forgot about the transcription of names in the book of eternal devotion by the half-blind love demon. I squirm. You don't think that's a little old-fashioned? I mean, my cousin Jeremy didn't have candles at his wedding, and his marriage turned out fine, even without the love demon's transcription of names. Dorothy darts her eyes at me, and I know what she's thinking. Wasn't my cousin Jeremy just last week complaining about the new carpets his wife bought for the second flailing sanctuary they installed in their above-ground prayer hut? Maybe they'd have better communication skills if they'd had candles at their wedding so the half-blind love demon could accurately transcribe their names in his book. I can tell this is a battle I'm not going to win. But I stress again, obviously, we can't do everything. We're trying to keep things simple. Nikki is unmoved by this argument. Okay, but how complicated is it to get candles? I'm not saying you should rent a blimp or something. It's candles. You can literally get them at the Rite Aid. Dorothy looks at me with her big hazelnut chocolate eyes. And I know this is something she wants. Even though she's the one who said in the first place that we should keep things simple. Well, let's just see what they have at the Rite Aid, I offer. Dorothy lights up like the Yuletide hogfire, and I resign myself to the idea that we are definitely going to have candles of ascending height lining the aisle at our wedding. But the main thing everyone has an opinion about is when in the ceremony to sacrifice the goats to the stone god. You want to do it early, says my mother. That way you get it out of the way and everyone knows the stone god has been appeased, so this is a legal and blessed marriage. Are you kidding? Says my little brother. He's studying to be a goat slaughterer at the university, so of course he has a lot of ideas about everything. You know how much blood that is? You have to do the slaughtering at the end, otherwise you're going to slip in goat guts while you're doing the dance of the cuckolded woodland sprite, and the blood will get all over your marriage cloak, and the video will end up on one of those wedding fail blogs. In that moment, I don't have the heart to tell him we're not even planning on doing the dance of the cuckolded woodland sprite, and we probably aren't going to be wearing traditional marriage cloaks, and we definitely aren't hiring a videographer. My mother shakes her head. It's actually not that much blood. She looks right at my brother. If you get a good slaughterer. His face gets all flush like it always does when he feels like no one's taking him seriously. Even if you get the best slaughterer in town, he says. Even if you get Joseph the Forever Sanctified, please. My mother scoffs. You couldn't get Joseph the Forever Sanctified with this little notice. Even if you could, my brother says. I'm telling you, it's going to be a lot of blood. Dorothy put the napkin over her pasta marinara. I'm done eating. I'm sorry, I say on the drive home from the Olive Garden. I know my family's a little intense. I love your family, says Dorothy. They're just trying to help. We should have eloped, I say. We could have avoided all this stress and spent the money on a honeymoon. Even as I'm saying it, I know that's a stupid thing to say because, A, what money? The only reason we can afford to have a wedding at all is because Dorothy's dad is a real mover and or shaker over at the Divinatory Rune Company, and he got his branch to sponsor us. I was a little ambivalent at first about having a corporate-sponsored wedding, but it is Dorothy's dad, after all. It's not like we're just shilling for lenscrafters or something. And if it means we get to have our wedding at the good church, with the stained-glass windows and the comfortable seats, instead of the multi-purpose room at the rec center, which, no matter how many candles you light, always smells a little like disinfectant and cottage cheese. Like as if someone tried to use disinfectant to cancel out the cottage cheese smell, but then it smelled too much like disinfectant, so they brought in more cottage cheese, and they're still to this day struggling to get the perfect disinfectant-to-cottage-cheese ratio. Well, if we can avoid that whole mess, then maybe it's worth a few tasteful Divinatory Rune Company banners and a brief mention in our vows of the many benefits and useful applications of affordable, twice-sanctified Divinatory runes. But furthermore, B, even if we could afford to go somewhere for a honeymoon, we both know I couldn't take the time off. I'm already planning on working over harvest week, since the quarry pays time and a half on all holidays, and I'm counting on that bump to help cover rent while Dorothy's getting her master's in social work. Really, the only thing stressing me out is the goats thing, says Dorothy. Once we figure out what to do with the goats, everything else falls into place. All of a sudden, I have a crazy idea. So crazy, I feel like I can't even say it out loud, but as soon as it worms its way into my head, I feel like I can't not say it. So I blurt out, "You want to just not sacrifice any goats?" Dorothy is silent for a moment, and I know that as soon as I stop the car, she's going to get out and run away and never talk to me again, and the next time I see her is going to be in a photo on the cover of a trashy tabloid at the checkout line with the headline, "My fiancé didn't want to sacrifice goats." But instead, Dorothy says, "Can we do that?" And I say, "Dorothy, it's our wedding. We can do whatever we want." She smiles. And I feel like how Clark Kent must feel when he overhears someone talking about Superman. But doing whatever we want turns out to be a real headache when we're applying for our marriage license. "How many goats are you going to sacrifice to the stone god?" asks the woman at window 5. "We're not going to sacrifice any goats to the stone god," I say proudly. "It's not that kind of wedding." The woman looks down at her form and then back up at us. "So, just like 5 then?" "No," says Dorothy. "0. The man behind us in line groans and makes a big show out of looking at his watch. "I don't understand," says the woman. "You mean like 1 or 2? The stone god is not going to like getting so few goats." "No," I say, "not 1 or 2. 0. We are sacrificing 0 goats to the stone god." She crinkles up her nose. "Well, there's not an option on the form for 0, so I'm just going to put you down for 5. Next thing I know, we get a visit from Dorothy's best friend, Nikki. "I heard you're only going to sacrifice 5 goats." "No," I start to say, but she cuts me off. "If you don't sacrifice at least 38 goats, my mom's not going to come. You know she's a traditionalist about this sort of thing." "Well, this wedding is not about your mom," snaps Dorothy. "We don't want to do the goats thing, and if she can't support that, if she can't support us, then your mom shouldn't come." "Wow," says Nikki. And then she says it again, for emphasis. Wow. Of course my little brother is heartbroken. What am I supposed to tell all my friends in goat slaughtering class when it gets out that my brother isn't sacrificing goats at his wedding? I'll be a laughingstock. It's not about you, I say. None of this is about anybody except for the two people who are getting married to each other. You seem tense, my mother says. You're sure you wouldn't feel better if you just sacrificed 10 goats? 10? Says my brother. That's an insult. Honestly, at that point, you're better off just not sacrificing any and hoping the stone god doesn't notice. Yeah, I say. That's the idea. Okay, says my mother. Forget about the goats. But I'm worried about you and Dorothy, trying to organize this whole thing by yourselves. It's not a whole thing, I say. That's actually kind of the point, that it's not a whole thing. Why don't you meet with a wedding planner? Maybe having someone else will ease the tension off the two of you. There's no tension, I say, a little too loud and a little too fast, in a manner that makes it seem like there is definitely some tension. It sounds like there's some tension, observes my little brother, who, when he's done learning about slaughtering goats, could probably benefit from a class in minding his own business. The only tension is coming from the outside, I say. It's outside tension. There's no tension between Dorothy and me. Besides, who's going to pay for a wedding planner? I can't ask Dorothy's dad for more money. So don't hire a wedding planner, says my mom. Just meet with one, see what she has to say. So we set up a meeting with Clarissa, the planner of weddings. The first thing you need to know about us, Dorothy says to Clarissa, the planner of weddings, is that we're really not looking for a big complicated extravaganza with a lot of moving parts. And I'm so happy that Dorothy says this, confirming again that we are in fact 100% not having tension.
Okay, says Clarissa. What are you looking for?
It's very simple, I say. We walk down the aisle. Dorothy looks beautiful. I'm wearing a suit. The officiant says a few words about love. Then I say a few words. Then Dorothy says a few words. Maybe Aunt Estelle reads a Gertrude Stein poem. Then the officiant says, well, do you love each other? I say, yep. Dorothy says, yep. Then we kiss, and everyone claps, and then we dance.
The dance of the cuckolded woodland sprite?
No, not the dance of the cuckolded woodland sprite. Just normal dancing. Like twist and shout. Or crazy in love. That kind of thing. We do that for a couple hours, and then everyone goes home. Just like your basic IKEA one-size-fits-all wedding.
But that's so unromantic,
says Dorothy's best friend, Nikki, who is also at this meeting for some reason. It's actually very romantic, I say, because it's just about us. It's not about all this other stuff that has nothing to do with us.
What does Gertrude Stein have to do with anything? Scoffs Nikki.
Dorothy smiles.
We both love Gertrude Stein. On one of our first dates, we went to see Dr. Faustus Lights the Lights. I love that part, says the planner of weddings. It's special, it's specific to you, and it means something. But I do want to circle back to the whole not having a big ceremony thing. How solid are you on that idea? 1 to 10.
10, I say.
10, says Dorothy. Okay, so pretty solid, but maybe there's a little bit of wiggle room there.
No, I say.
No, says Dorothy. Okay, I love that you two are on the same page. I do want to make sure you're thinking about all this practically, though, because part of the reason for having a big ceremony is that it could get interrupted at any time by the sudden weeping and flailing and shouting of lamentations by the shrieking chorus. The weeping and flailing and shouting of lamentations could go on for at least 20 minutes. So if you don't have enough other stuff going on, suddenly the whole thing becomes about the shrieking chorus, and then you're not getting that special small feeling you're looking for. Trust me, I've seen it happen.
Dorothy sinks in her chair, and I try to stay strong, for both of us. But that's part of what I'm saying. We're not going to have a shrieking chorus. Dorothy spins like a lighthouse and shines directly at me.
Wait, are we really not having a shrieking chorus? That's half the fun of a wedding, says Nikki.
It is not half the fun, I protest, but Nikki doubles down.
Literally, 50% of the fun of a wedding is that you never know when the shrieking chorus is going to start the weeping and flailing and shouting of lamentations. If you don't have a shrieking chorus, why are you even having a wedding?
Because we love each other, I argue meekly.
And I feel like if I have to say it one more time, we won't even need a shrieking chorus because I will start weeping and flailing and shouting lamentations all by myself.
Dorothy's still mulling it over.
I guess it never occurred to me that we wouldn't even have a small shrieking chorus. It doesn't really feel like a wedding without one.
The planner of weddings grimaces, like she's really embarrassed that we're having this discussion in front of her, like this is the first time she's ever seen a couple have a disagreement about the details of a wedding.
It sounds like you two need to have some more conversations with each other before I can really know how to help you.
Definitely, says Nikki proudly. And I think that if Nikki loves Clarissa so much, maybe they should be the ones getting married, and then they can have all the shrieking choruses they want. At this point, we could both use a pick-me-up, so I take Dorothy to the ceremonial egg store to look at the promise eggs. I know technically it's bad luck for a bride to see her promise egg before the ceremony, but it is becoming increasingly apparent that Dorothy has maybe more ideas about this wedding than she initially let on when we decided together that we were both cool with a very easy, very small wedding without frills or complications. And it is furthermore becoming increasingly apparent that if I go pick out a promise egg without her input, I'm going to screw it up. And then it's going to sit in a display case in our living room for the rest of our marriage. A testament to how badly I screwed it up. A testament to how I always screw things up. A testament to how I will continue to screw things up forever. Everyone at the ceremonial egg store is very friendly and excited for us.
Congratulations, says Sabrina, the person of sales. You guys are an amazing couple, I can already tell. And I want to help you find the perfect promise egg. Tell me what you're looking for. Just shout some words at me. Let's get real loose.
Something on the smaller side, I say. Maybe 1.5 to 2 feet tall. Sabrina nods.
Small eggs are very in right now. You have excellent taste. Are we thinking silver, platinum, rose gold?
I somehow muster the confidence to mumble. We were thinking maybe we could start with the copper ones.
Sabrina doesn't miss a beat. Of course, we have some lovely copper eggs. That's a fabulous place to start. I'm going to go pull some options.
Sorry, Dorothy says. I know you probably get paid on commission.
Sabrina laughs. We're going to find something amazing, I promise.
She squeezes Dorothy's arm and heads to the back room. You don't need to apologize, I say. I feel bad. We belong here just as much as anybody, I tell Dorothy, and also myself. Sabrina, the person of sales, shows us a series of copper eggs, each just slightly more expensive than I was hoping to pay. Each just slightly not quite the promise egg that Dorothy always imagined for herself. She puts on a brave face, but I can hear the disappointment in her voice when she says, "This one kind of feels like the promise egg my grandparents have." Sabrina nods.
"Well, the copper eggs do tend to be a little more traditional."
Across the shop, another couple is having a blast in the platinum egg section. The man is trying to lift a 4-foot egg and making a lot of goofy faces. They look like they got dressed up special just for going shopping, or else maybe right after getting the egg, they're going yachting or golfing or something, or else maybe they just always dress this nice. I suddenly notice how dirty my jeans are. "You don't have anything maybe a little nicer than these?" I ask. I've been in houses with copper promise eggs before, and they've always seemed adequate, but here in the store next to all the other eggs, it's clear how dinky and unremarkable they are. I watch Dorothy run her finger over the crude butterfly molding on one of the eggs, and I can tell she's thinking the same thing, even though she would never admit it.
"Do you want to maybe look at some silver ones?" asks Sabrina. "I get that you don't want anything too fancy, but we have some very modest options in silver."
Dorothy looks at me like, "Can we?" "Let's just look at the silver eggs," I say, a sentence that immediately vaults to the top of the dumbest things I've ever said chart, barely edging out, "Can I get it extra spicy?" and, "I like the way your hair looked before." Sabrina, the person of sales, takes us into a back room, and the first thing she shows us is a 1954 Felix Wojnowski silver egg, adorned with rare gems and festooned with religious iconography. "This one's probably a little too showy, don't you think?" I say, assuring everyone in the room that my primary concern lies not in matters of price, but in ostentation.
"I don't know," says Dorothy. "I think it's nice."
"Yeah," I say, "it's definitely nice, but maybe a little too showy."
"How about this one?" asks Sabrina. "This is the new trend. It's silver-plated, so it's elegant, but it doesn't feel too heavy."
Dorothy nods.
"You hear that, Peter? Silver-plated."
I smile.
and glanced down at the price tag. It's 8 times what the most expensive copper eggs cost.
Yeah, these are some great options, I say. You're really giving us a lot to think about. But Dorothy is done thinking. I want to be surprised at the wedding, so I'm going to go wait in the car. Peter, I'm sure I'm going to love whatever you pick.
She heads out, and Sabrina smiles at me and says,
Should we look at some platinum options?
I cringe. I wish you could see our apartment. People like us don't normally get promise eggs like these.
Well, it actually isn't uncommon for a promise egg to be the nicest thing you own, Sabrina offers helpfully.
Do you think if I get a copper one, Dorothy will hate me forever?
Of course not. She said she'll love whatever you pick. And I think it's important to take people at their word.
I nod.
That said, she continues for some reason, her eyes really lit up when she saw the Wisnowski.
I think about Dorothy. I think about our first date, when I tried to take her to the drive-in movie, but my credit card was declined. I felt like a real idiot. But she had the idea to drive up the hill and watch the whole thing without sound. We made up the dialogue ourselves, which turned out to be even more fun and romantic in a stupid sort of way, and I promised myself that night that I would do whatever I could to love this woman for the rest of my life. Can you just hold on to the Wisnowski? I ask. I can't afford it now, but I want to get it. Sabrina grimaces.
I'm not really supposed to, but you guys seem so in love. I could probably stash it somewhere for a couple weeks.
She winks at me, and my heart is full of baby birds leaping into flight, and I make a mental note to write a good review on Yelp, and also to name our first daughter after Sabrina, the person of sales. I slide into the car, and Dorothy says,
Don't tell me what you got. I want to be surprised.
I didn't get anything, I say. I decided to make an egg myself out of construction paper and pipe cleaners.
Har har.
Then,
not really though, right?
I thought you wanted to be surprised.
This must be a great place to work, says Dorothy, because all day you're around happy couples who are in love and you're helping them plan their future together.
I say, yeah, and you don't even need a master's in social work. Dorothy gives me a look like, okay, buddy, and I give her a look like, I'm just saying, and she gives me a look like, what am I going to do with you? The good news is the very next day there's an accident at the quarry and Frankie Scharf breaks her fibula. This is not good news for Frankie Scharf, who already has a husband on disability, or for Joey Slotnick, the guy who has to climb the ladder to reset the days since a work-related accident sign. Because while he's trying to maneuver around the giant zero, he falls off the ladder and breaks his fibula. But it's great news for me, because it means I can pick up extra shifts at the quarry. That itself is a mixed blessing, I know, because the more hours I work, the more likely it is that I'll have an accident and break my fibula. But as I see it, the pros outweigh the cons. As I see it, the pros are, 1, it makes me look like a real go-getter and team player to David and David in the front office. 2, I get paid more money. This is a crucial pro, because it means I can cover unplanned for expenses as they arise, such as, say, when my fiancé suddenly decides she wants a Wisnowski promise egg, or a shrieking chorus at our wedding, even though she knows that those are things we did not budget for. 3, I get paid more money. This is related to the previous pro, but not exactly the same. The previous, I get paid more money, is a practical matter, but this one is more spiritual. While I'm working extra hours at the quarry, I can think about how I'm earning more money to cover the wedding and also cover the life I'm going to spend with my future wife. This gives me a good feeling to be a provider, which is so embarrassing and old-fashioned, and if anyone asked me about it, I deny it, but the truth is, it feels good. 4. It keeps me away from fighting with Dorothy about wedding stuff. This one I feel less good about, but the truth is, the closer we get to the wedding, the more we argue. Our newest disagreement is about whether to take part in the traditional week of lying with the Grand Priest Kenny Sorgenfrey.
I have to lie with the Grand Priest Kenny Sorgenfrey, Dorothy says, so he can confirm to the whole village I am a virgin.
But you're not a virgin, I say. Neither of us is.
That's not the point, she says. It's tradition. If the Grand Priest Kenny Sorgenfrey doesn't tell the whole village I'm a virgin, my mother will be mortified.
So she goes to lie with the Grand Priest, and I work more hours at the quarry. I bring a casserole to Frankie Scharf's place. This is maybe a mistake, because even though Frankie's real glad to see a friend from work, the whole situation really bums me out. She's in a tiny apartment with her husband and three kids.
I feel bad for judging, because, of course, we're all doing what we can, but the sink is full of dishes, the walls are water damaged. Again, it's not Frankie's fault or the fault of her husband, who really is a decent guy, but the worst part of all is the promise egg on display in the corner. I recognize it as one of the copper eggs from the store, one I had half convinced myself to buy for Dorothy and me. In the shop, it looks simple, modest, elegant even. But in Frankie's apartment, I see it for what it really is. Cheap. I go back to the egg store and I buy the Wojnowski. I put it on two credit cards. I figure if I take all my vacation days on non-holidays, I can work over the holidays and get overtime for it. Do I want to pay $50 more to get our names engraved on the 1954 Felix Wojnowski sterling silver egg? You bet I do. Do I also want to buy the special display case that goes with the egg? Absolutely. And who's going to hold the egg during the ceremony? We can rent a eunuch for you through the Church of the Wine God, offers Sabrina, the person of sales. They know what they're doing. The Wojnowski is heavier than it looks, and I've seen more than one wedding ruined because they asked a random uncle to hold the promise egg, and then he dropped it in the middle of the ceremony. Okay, I say, let's get that eunuch. That night, I'm too excited to sleep, so I drive to the ravine and look out over the water. I think about Dorothy currently lying with the Grand Priest with no idea what her future husband just did for her. I know the egg doesn't matter. I know what really matters is how much I love her. But the egg is a symbol for that love. And when I think about what a nice symbol I got, I feel proud and I feel lucky and I feel blessed. I think about Dorothy. I think about the way she rests her head on my chest as we fall asleep. And I feel proud and I feel lucky and I feel blessed. Then the worst possible thing happens. Gavin Kachevsky works a double shift at the quarry and conks out at the power drill, and five guys end up breaking their fibulas. David and David call an all-staff meeting. No more double shifts, says one of the Davids, the David who talks. Too many guys are breaking their fibulas. The crowd groans, and the other David, the one who doesn't talk, whispers something in the first David's ear. Also, says David, as of today, we are no longer offering time and a half for work over holidays. That's not fair, I shout. I have been counting on that money. Me too, shouts Jose, whose kitchen recently fell into a sinkhole. We all have, shouts Deb, who has a kid with real silly bones.
It's not about the money, says David. This is about your safety. We're a family here at the quarry, and if we keep breaking fibulas on the job, our insurance rates go way up, and then we're going to have to start laying people off. We really don't want to do that because, again, family. So you're saying we can't work over the holidays?
The David who doesn't talk whispers something into the ear of the David who does talk, and he nods.
No, you definitely can, he says. In fact, we'd appreciate it if you would. We just can't pay you time and a half because that would be incentivizing it.
Unbelievable, says Kath Chung.
Kath is the real rabble-rouser, and for a moment it seems like she's really about to start rousing some rabble. But before she can get too into it, the David who doesn't talk says loudly, "This is not up for debate." And we all at once realize the severity of the moment, because when the David who doesn't talk talks, that's when you know things have gotten serious. I return to the egg store. Sabrina, the person of sales, greets me with a big smile.
Hey, big guy, did you want to take another gander at your masterpiece?
I can't look her in the eye. I need to trade it in. It's too much.
She looks at me like I'm speaking another language.
You can't trade it in. You already got it engraved.
Okay, well, can I at least get the money back for the eunuch? We don't need him. We'll just leave the egg in the stand.
That was a donation to the Church of the Wine God. You can't just take that back.
Sabrina, you gotta help me out here. Is there anything you can do for me?
Sabrina looks both ways, then leans in and whispers,
I can give you a coupon for 20% off your next purchase.
I explode. Why would I ever need to purchase another promise egg?
Not knowing what else to do, I hightail it to the Divinatory Rune Company and take the elevator all the way to the top. Dorothy's father is in his office, looking out his window over the factory floor, overseeing the polishing and blessing of divinatory runes.
Peter, what can I do for you?
Well, it's about the wedding.
Oh?
It's about money.
Oh.
And I mumble-mumble something, promise egg, mumble-mumble, can't afford it. Dorothy's father sits down. He looks pained. The promise egg symbolizes the promise you're making to my daughter. The promise to provide for her and keep her safe. If I'm paying for it, what kind of message does that send?
I can work it off, I say. After my shift at the quarry, let me come here for a stint on the polishing line. Dorothy doesn't even have to know. He takes a deep breath and looks at me like I'm a salad he just found a dead bug in and he's trying to figure out whether it's worth it to call the waitress over and send me back.
Peter, I really wish you'd reconsider about the goats. This throws me for a loop because by this point I honestly thought the goat thing was settled. As per the goats of it all, I start to say, but I'm immediately thrown off by the weirdness of starting a sentence with the phrase as per the goats of it all. That was a poor choice. I thought I could pull it off. I couldn't pull it off. Look, he says, I get it. At our wedding, we wanted to keep things small, so we only sacrificed 12 goats. But if you don't sacrifice any goats, the stone god is going to get angry, and he's going to put a curse on your house, and your first baby will come out a statue. Now that's something I simply won't allow.
Sir, I say, and it feels weird to call him sir, because when Dorothy and I first announced our engagement, he gave me a big hug and told me to call him Dad. But in this moment, I know it would be even weirder to call him Dad.
Sir, with all due respect, has that ever actually happened? Has anyone actually not done the sacrifice and then given birth to a statue?
It happened to Kyle's wife in chapter 12, verse 8 of the Book of Kyle.
Well, yeah, of course, obviously it happens in the Book of Kyle, but I mean, has it ever happened to anyone you actually know in your lifetime?
He takes a long drag off his cigar, the whole time looking me square in the eye.
Everyone I know, he says, made a sacrifice to the stone god.
He pulls out a pen that probably costs more than I get paid in a year and starts scribbling in a checkbook.
I'll tell you what, he says. You want to sacrifice goats? I'll pay for the goats. I'll pay for however many goats you want, and I'll even throw in a sizable chunk on top for the slaughterer. You want to ask your brother to slaughter the goats and use the money I give you on something else? Well, that's your business.
I appreciate that, but all I'm asking for is...
I think my offer is quite reasonable, he says.
I nod. Ashamed I even tried to negotiate with the guy who basically runs the local branch of the Divinatory Rune Company.
And I like to think I'm a reasonable man. A modern, sophisticated, sensible man. But no daughter of mine is getting married at a wedding without goat slaughter.
I go to the house of Sorgen Fry. Kenny answers the door in a bathrobe.
Hey, brother. I need to talk to Dorothy. Ooh, no can do, buddy. The groom is not supposed to see the bride as she lies with the Grand Priest.
I have to talk to her. Tell her it's an emergency.
Kenny Sorgen Fry pouts, squints at me, then closes the door. A few minutes later, Dorothy emerges in a bathrobe.
What is it? What's wrong?
First of all, hi, you look beautiful.
Peter, what is going on? I've been thinking about the wedding and I think we should sacrifice goats.
Dorothy quickly whittles the word furious into a verb and furiouses at me.
That's the emergency?
Well, the wedding's in 2 weeks and I need to put an order in at the wholesale goat outlet.
Okay, so when I want to lie with the Grand Priest, it's stupid and old-fashioned, but because your brother slaughters goats, suddenly, no, it's not about that. Weren't you the one who wanted to keep things small? Actually, I say you were the one who wanted to keep things small, but we can just sacrifice 10 goats. What's the big deal? It'll make a lot of people happy.
She tightens her bathrobe.
If today we say we're sacrificing 10 goats, tomorrow it's going to be 28, and then before we know it, we're going to be one of those 200-goat weddings where most of the ceremony is spent sacrificing goats. I'm just saying, if the stone god does put a curse on our house and our first baby comes out a statue, you're the one who's going to have to give birth to it.
She takes a deep breath. And for a second it feels like that's going to be the end of it. But then she says,
look.
And if there's one thing I know about being in a relationship, it's that no good sentence starts with the word look. No one ever says, look.
That's a great point. You're right. Let's stop arguing now.
Look, she says.
I've been doing a lot of thinking, partly on my own and partly in conversation with the Grand Priest, Kenny Sorgen Fry.
Conversation? What conversation?
Multiple conversations, Peter.
Why are you having multiple conversations with Kenny Sorgen Fry? You're just supposed to lie with him. You don't need to have conversations.
Sometimes, after we lie with each other, we have conversations.
That's not part of it. Since when is that part of it?
Some guys, she says, with an edge in her voice, like to talk after, instead of just going to sleep. It's actually kind of nice.
Okay, so you have conversations. What are these conversations about?
As you know,
Kenny lies with a lot of brides, like most brides, and he says he doesn't usually see brides who have so many doubts.
Well, if there's one other thing I know about being in a relationship, it's that even worse than saying, look, is when someone says, I have doubts.
You have doubts?
Yeah.
I have a few doubts.
Suddenly, I feel like I'm talking to some other Dorothy. A new, different Dorothy I don't know how to talk to. I try to catch her eye, but she won't look at me. You're having conversations? You're having doubts? What's going on with you?
Recently, you've been spending so much time at the quarry, I feel like I never see you, and I don't think that augurs well for our marriage.
It doesn't augur well? Who says augur well? Did Kenny Sorgenfry say that?
Well, he put it into words, but I was separately feeling already like the auguring of it wasn't so good.
I have been busting my ass at the quarry so I could afford to give you the perfect wedding.
It doesn't feel that way. It feels like you've been working late hours because you don't want to be around me.
You think I don't want to be around you?
I'm just saying it feels that way.
Well, if I don't want to be around you, then why am I marrying you? I don't know, she shouts. Why are you? I immediately think of 100 wrong things to say, but I can't for the life of me think of a single right thing to say. So instead, I shout the most unwrong of the wrong things I can think of, which is all the normal reasons. I have never heard a person say a sentence with such disdain as the way Dorothy spits back at me.
All the normal reasons?
Yeah, I say, the normal reasons. Like, I love you and I want to spend the rest of my life with you. It's all the dumb cliches about how even when I'm mad at you, I love you. And how every day the best part of it is waking up next to you. And it kills me that this is all the normal, typical people in love stuff. Because I want to believe our love is special, that it's bigger and more interesting than any love that anyone else has had before. But the heartbreaking truth is, my love for you is so consistent and predictable and boring. I can see Dorothy soften a little, which is good because I don't have anything else to say.
Is that why you want goats at our wedding?
As per the goats of it all, I promised your dad we would have them. I needed more money from him because I got you the Felix Wisnowski promise egg and I couldn't afford it.
Dorothy holds a hand up to her mouth. Her eyes go wide. You got the Wisnowski?
Yeah, I say. It's stupid. The whole thing is stupid. But I love you. Dorothy smiles.
Well, there's nothing stupid about that, she says, in a detached adjacent tone. I can tell she intends to sound cool, but because her voice cracks and her eyes sparkle with tears, it comes across like the most sincere thing in the world.
No,
I ask. And she shakes her head. Are you kidding? She says gently, sweetly. I'm a goddamn delight.
Now, let me tell you. I thought Dorothy was beautiful before, but when I'm standing at the altar and I see her walk into the good church in her marriage cloak, the stained glass windows behind her, well, I could live to be 100 and it would still be the loveliest thing I'd ever seen. And in that moment I think, this is the best possible way to have a wedding because it's the kind of wedding where while it's happening, I get to marry Dorothy. My little brother does the goat sacrifice himself. We settle on 50 goats, a good round number. And it goes off without a hitch. Except for a half hour later, during Aunt Estelle's reading of the Gertrude Stein poem, it turns out one of the goats didn't all the way die, and it bucks off the sacrificial altar and scrambles up and down the aisle, braying and squealing and shooting blood everywhere. My little brother jumps up and tries to tackle it, but it's a slippery little thing all lubed up with the blood and guts of 49 other goats. Blood is squirting everywhere, and my mother leans in and whispers, "This is why you get a professional goat slaughterer." Of course, this sets off one of the guys in the shrieking chorus. He starts weeping and flailing and shouting lamentations. And then the guy next to him starts weeping and flailing and shouting lamentations. And before you know it, all 12 of them are climbing over the pews, their eyes rolled back in their heads, weeping and flailing and shouting lamentations. Meanwhile, Aunt Estelle is still reading the Gertrude Stein poem, and she doesn't know what to do, so she just starts reading it louder and louder. My mother leans in and whispers, "For God's sake, will you go help your little brother?" I run into the aisle, and my brother chases the goat right into my arms. I slip in blood and fall on my ass, but I hold tight of the wriggling thing so it can't escape. My brother is shaking, and I realize too late why most couples wait until the end of the wedding to give the ceremonial goat-slaughtering knife to the youngest cousin to throw into the ravine. It always felt so anticlimactic to end with that, which is why we sent little Tucker off early, but now I get it. You're going to want to hold on to that knife.
What now? My brother asks. I don't know,
I shout while struggling to get a better grip on the convulsing beast. You're supposed to be the big goat expert! Then Dorothy shouts something, but I can't quite hear her over the chaos, and also Aunt Estelle. Dorothy shouts again and points to the eunuch at the back of the church, and I yell to my brother, "The egg!" He runs back and wrestles the big silver thing out of the eunuch's hands. The eunuch has taken an oath to the wine god to protect the egg at all costs until the end of the ceremony, so he doesn't let it go easily, but then my brother punches him in the face and he staggers back. I cringe, thinking about how this must look to Dorothy's side of the family, not to mention the wine god, if he even really exists. And I'm sure my mother is thinking that she raised us boys better than that, but sometimes desperate times call for punching a eunuch in the face so you can steal his giant silver egg and use it as a blunt object. By this point, the shrieking chorus has started weeping and flailing their way into the aisle, so my brother has no choice but to run all the way around the side of the congregation to get back to me and the goat. I lie on my back and try to position the squirming animal in such a way that my brother can bash its head in quickly. He holds the egg high in the air, but then the goat's eye twitches and looks up at him, and suddenly my little brother melts. "Come on!" I shout as the goat bucks in my arms and kicks me in the stomach. "What are you waiting for?"
"I can't," says my little brother. "I can't do it."
He falls to his knees and cradles the silver egg in his arms like a baby. I feel bad for him, but also I can't help but think about all the money my parents wasted sending him to the university so he could major in goat slaughtering.
"Screw it," says Dorothy's best friend, Nikki. "I'll do it."
Nikki squeezes into the aisle and grabs the egg from my brother, but in her eagerness she knocks over one of the aisle-lining candles of ascending height, and when the flames hit the bottom of her dress, the whole thing lights up like a Yuletide hogfire. Nikki drops the egg and runs up and down the aisle all aflame. She's screaming, and the goat's screaming, and then everyone else starts screaming, except for Aunt Estelle, who, God bless her, has a job to do and isn't going to sit down until she finishes her poem. I look at my bride, who is standing at the altar, frozen, mouth agape, mouth very agape, like, for real, I guarantee you've never seen a mouth so agape. She looks at me with her big, forest-flavored eyes like, "Can you believe this?" And I look at her like, "Well, what did we expect?" The goat convulses in my arms and Dorothy starts laughing. Then she puts her arm up and juts her chin out, like she's about to start doing the dance of the cuckolded woodland sprite, and I start laughing. She's laughing and I'm laughing, and I swear to gods I'm the luckiest man in the world. I look at her, lit by fire, caked in blood, scored by the shrieking of the chorus and the wailing of a dying goat, and I wish I could marry her again. I wish I could marry her 100,000 times.
Misconnection. M for W. Read by Coleman Domingo. I saw you on the Manhattan-bound Brooklyn Q train. I was wearing a blue-striped t-shirt and a pair of maroon pants. You were wearing a vintage green skirt and a cream-colored top. You got on at DeKalb and sat across from me, and we made eye contact briefly. I fell in love with you a little bit. In that stupid way where you completely make up a fictional version of the person you're looking at and fall in love with that person. But still, I think there was something there. Several times we looked at each other and then looked away. I tried to think of something to say to you, maybe pretend I didn't know where I was going and ask you for directions, or say something nice about your boot-shaped earrings, or just say, "Hot day." It all seemed so stupid. At one point, I caught you staring at me, and you immediately averted your eyes. You pulled a book out of your bag and started reading it, a biography of Lyndon Johnson, but I noticed you never once turned a page. My stop was Union Square, but at Union Square I decided to stay on, rationalizing that I could just as easily transfer to the 7 at 42nd Street, but then I didn't get off at 42nd Street either. You must have missed your stop as well. Because when we got all the way to the end of the line at 96, we both just sat there in the car, waiting. I looked over at you and tilted my head, curious. You shrugged and held up your book. You'd missed your stop because you were distracted, that's all. We took the train all the way back down, down the Upper East Side, weaving through Midtown, from Times Square to Herald Square to Union Square, under Soho and Chinatown, up across the bridge back into Brooklyn, past Barclays and Prospect Park, past Flatbush and Midwood and Sheepshead Bay, all the way to Coney Island. And when we got to Coney Island, I knew I had to say something. Still, I said nothing. And so we went back up. Up and down the queue line, over and over. We caught the rush hour crowds and then saw them thin out again. We watched the sun set over Manhattan as we crossed the East River. I gave myself deadlines. I'll talk to her before Newkirk. I'll talk to her before Canal. Still, I remained silent. For months, we sat on the train saying nothing. We survived on bags of Skittles sold to us by kids raising money for their basketball teams. We must have heard a million mariachi bands, had our faces nearly kicked in by 100,000 breakdancers. I gave money to the panhandlers until I ran out of singles. When the train went above ground, I'd get text messages and voicemails. Where are you? What happened? Are you okay? Until my phone battery ran out. I'll talk to her before daybreak. I'll talk to her before Tuesday. The longer I waited, the harder it got. What could I possibly say to you now? Now that we'd passed this same station for the 100th time. Maybe, if I could go back to the first time the queue switched over to the local R line for the weekend, I could have said, well, this is inconvenient. But I couldn't say it now, could I? I would kick myself for days after every time you sneezed. Why hadn't I said, bless you? That tiny gesture could have been enough to pivot us into a conversation. But here, in stupid silence, we sat. There were nights when we were the only two souls in the car, perhaps even on the whole train, and even then I felt self-conscious about bothering you. She's reading her book, I thought. She doesn't want to talk to me. Still, there were moments when I felt a connection. Someone would shout something crazy about Jesus, and we'd immediately look at each other to register our reactions. A couple of teenagers would exit, holding hands, and we'd both think, young love. For 60 years, we sat in that car, just barely pretending not to notice each other. I got to know you so well, if only peripherally. I memorized the folds of your body, the contours of your face, the patterns of your breath. I saw you cry once, after you'd glanced at a neighbor's newspaper. I wondered if you were crying about something specific or just the general passage of time. So unnoticeable, until suddenly noticeable. I wanted to comfort you, wrap my arms around you, assure you everything would be fine, but it felt too familiar. I stayed glued to my seat. One day, in the middle of the afternoon, you stood up as the train pulled into Avenue J. It was difficult for you, this simple task of standing up. You hadn't done it in 60 years. Holding on to the rails, you managed to get yourself to the door. You hesitated briefly there, perhaps waiting for me to say something, giving me one last chance to stop you, but rather than spit out a lifetime of suppressed almost conversations, I said nothing. And I watched you slip out between the closing sliding doors. It took a few more stops before I realized you were really gone. I kept waiting for you to re-enter the subway car, sit down next to me, rest your head on my shoulder. Nothing would be said. Nothing would need to be said. When the train returned to Avenue J, I craned my neck as we entered the station. Perhaps you were there on the platform, still waiting. Perhaps I would see you smiling and bright, your long white hair waving in the wind from the oncoming train. But no. You were gone. And I realized, most likely I would never see you again. And I thought about how amazing it is that you can know somebody for 60 years, and yet still not really know that person at all. I stayed on the train until it got to Union Square, at which point I got off and transferred to the L.
The Serial Monogamous Guide to Important New York City Landmarks, read by Natalie Morales. Towering over the east side of Fifth Avenue, between 50th and 51st Streets, you'll find the majestic St. Patrick's Cathedral, historically significant as the place where you and Eric sat on the steps and ate frozen yogurt that time. Should you happen upon this neo-Gothic-style, still-active Roman Catholic church, you'll be instantly transported to that ancient day, several summers prior, when the two of you were finally getting along again, for the first time in what seemed like forever. It felt like old times, this excursion into Manhattan, and you smiled as the sticky sweet swirl of hazelnut and banana melted down your arm. At one point, Eric looked at you and, grinning, said, "Hey, you've got a little, And as he reached for your face, you instinctively jerked away from his hand. You didn't mean anything by it, this flinch. It just happened. But in an instant, the whole day fell apart. You and Eric looked at each other in the shadow of that cathedral, and you saw Eric's face fall as you had often seen it fall in that just-so-Eric way. "What are we doing?" Eric asked. And you shook your head and said, "I don't know." And then the two of you sat on the steps of the cathedral for a very long time without saying anything. Later, you and Eric went back to his apartment and had sex, but it was too late. The damage had been done. New York City is full of history. Take, for example, the Waverly Diner down in Greenwich Village. It was at this very spot you and Keith stayed up all night talking over pancakes after ducking out of Emily's 26th birthday party. There's so much to say to each other, you and Keith. It was right after you and Eric broke up, and Keith was so not Eric. Keith was like the opposite of everything Eric stood for. If you had been thinking rationally at the time, you probably could have guessed that you would end up hurting Keith in ways he didn't deserve. But that night, everything seemed so perfect. You wanted Keith, and you felt like you had earned him somehow. It felt like all your life had been persistently preparing you for meeting this man. You still sometimes pass the Waverly Diner down in Greenwich Village on the Avenue of the Americas, but you rarely go inside it, and you never order the pancakes. Was ever a city so ruined by history, so smothered in the blood of past conflagration? Once, while haphazardly browsing the restoration hardware on 9th Avenue and 13th, killing time before meeting Boris's parents for a walk up the High Line, you idly picked up a loose spatula that suddenly reminded you of a fight you'd had 2 years earlier in Keith's kitchen. The conversation had started innocuously enough when Keith asked, "What do you want in your omelet?" and somehow ended 2 hours later when he shouted, "I don't think you really love me. I think you're just terrified of being alone." And you, gesticulating wildly with the spatula, spat back without thinking, "I am alone. You have no idea how alone I am." As if that were some kind of comeback. The spatula you now held in the restoration hardware was the same, the architecture of it surprisingly familiar, the weight of it in your hand alarmingly potent. And when you breathlessly explained to Boris the story of the artifact's eerie significance, he scrunched up his nose and said, "If the two of us are ever going to move forward at some point, you're going to have to stop looking backward." You'd already started dating Sean when Boris called late, drunk, and asked if you wanted to go to Staten Island. You'd never been to Staten Island, and Boris had never been to Staten Island, and since Boris was about to move to Philadelphia, this seemed like a good time as any to visit Staten Island. Boris had also invited you to go to Philadelphia with him, but that felt too far, too much, too soon, too Boris. Instead, you chose New York. You broke up with Boris, got your own place in Bushwick, and started dating Sean, the cute bartender at Union Pool. You didn't think you'd see Boris again, but on his last night in New York, he called you late, drunk, to invite you on an adventure. The truth is, there's not much to see on Staten Island. Not after midnight, anyway. The boat ride there is awfully romantic, but once you get there, well, there's the elevator ride up to the top floor of the ferry building, and if you're bored, you can take it back down again. There's a fish tank in the ferry building and some reading material posted at the base of it about the logistics of housing a fish tank in the Staten Island ferry building. It's a very large fish tank, so heavy the floor has to be supported with iron beams. "It's a big deal, this fish tank. A lot of work went into it," says the placard at the base. To the best of your recollection, you haven't been back. "We did this all for you, visitors to Staten Island, so you'd better appreciate it." You remember standing next to Boris and reading the fish tank placard. You would have thought there'd be more to say to each other this night before you said goodbye forever, but it turns out you'd already said everything. So instead of going through it all again, you stood side by side in the silence of the ferry building and read the information at the base of the fish tank. "Welcome to Staten Island," it probably said. "We hope you enjoy your visit. Maybe if things were different, maybe if one of you weren't about to leave the city for good, you could come here again sometime. Maybe this could become something special, something bigger than just a thing you tried once, because hey, why not? But on the other hand, it's probably best not to think about it too much. Just enjoy this for what it is. You've still got the boat ride back to Manhattan to look forward to, and if you load yourself up with too many might-have-beens, the ferry will sink under all that weight.